Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Rachel Bloom, loves musical theater. And not just the good stuff.
I can't choose that, like, I love musical theater even when, like, I know the lyrics could be better, or even when, like, the emotion for this isn't earned, or even when it feels kind of paint by numbers, like a big orchestral swell or, like, a bunch of people tap dancing. It makes me smile.
Fair enough. It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Rachel Bloom. She's the star and creator of the CW's hit show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She'll tell me why she relates to Rebecca Bunch, the titular Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
As someone who let love throughout my life made me feel powerless, disenfranchised, crazy, obsessed, the opposite of empowered. So I really connected with the premise, and I didn't care, like, if it was PC or not. To me, it felt truthful. I don't care if, like, oh, but that's not, like, a likable character. Like, it's true.
Then Gloria Calderon-Kellett and Mike Royce. The two co-created the hit Netflix show One Day at a Time. They'll tell me how, after years of writing snarky, cynical jokes for TV, it was really nice to try out some sincerity for a change.
There are definitely shows I worked on where no feelings would have... you don't pitch feelings. It's,
right.
It's how many jokes can I think up right now?
Finally, you ever feel like watching a silly movie, like a dumb one, like the kind where Grammy Award winner Seal gets attacked by a pack of wolves? Well, have I got a movie for you. It's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My first guest is Rachel Bloom. When we talked in 2016, she just won a Golden Globe. And at the ceremony, she seemed legitimately shocked that she won. Not just because she beat Julia Louis-Dreyfus and all, but also because her show, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, is on the CW. And maybe a million people watch it, which is a lot, but it's not a lot for a network TV show. And also, I'm guessing, because her show is a little weird, or at least unusual. For one thing, it's a musical, two songs an episode. For another, it's a romantic comedy that is shockingly honest about feelings. I mean, it comes right from the heart. The theme song has a refrain about the title character being broken inside. It's also honest about gender. This song, from the first season of the show, is about getting ready for a date. It's called Sexy Getting Ready Song.
A first I make everything shiny and smooth.
Oh, yeah.
Cause I want my body to be so soft for you. I'm gonna make this night one you'll never forget. Cause boy, I know you like an hourglass silhouette. Let's see how the guys get ready. It's the sexy getting ready song. The sexy getting ready song. Fluffing and flouncing, giggling and laying, the sexy getting ready sound.
Rachel Bloom, welcome to Bullseye. It is great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I hope that I didn't...
That was my best impression of, like, what I would sound like if I was on public radio. Thank you for having me.
Do I really sound different when I'm on public radio?
Well, in the opening, you suddenly, like, went into radio voice, but now you're just talking.
That's what you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to have... announcer voice when you're reading something.
It went a little lower. I feel like you're accessing. It's not like you're faking anything. It's like you're accessing more of a bass.
Oh, that's my theater training.
More of a Fraser Crane.
I'm supporting my diaphragm.
There you go.
I found my resonance.
Ha. Huh.
Yeah, you got it. Exactly. Rachel Bloom, for the benefit of our radio audience, knows that in order to find your resonance, you put your hand on your chest, then go through your entire register from high to low, and find where you feel the most vibration.
There you go. Where'd
you go
to school?
The center of your voice. I went to School of the Arts in San Francisco, high school.
Ooh.
Where'd you go to school, Rachel Bloom?
I grew up in California, went to public high school here, and then I went to New York University.
one of the things about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend that is so great, and there's a lot of them. I'm a big fan of the show.
Hey, thanks.
No problem. Is that it is very specific about Southern California in a way that Southern California is rarely seen specifically in film and television. Like, there's so much Southern California in film and television.
Yeah.
But so little of what most of Southern California is.
Well, most people who live here and are in entertainment, 9 times out of 10 have come from the East Coast. So they have a very, like, you know, recently moved to Southern California, probably moved here with a job to seek success. They have a very specific view of it. I grew up here similarly feeling like an outsider, but I was born here and grew up here the whole time wanting to be on the East Coast, but like being kind of stuck here. And so when I think of Southern California, I don't automatically think like the industry I'm in. I think about my childhood and like my parents being cold in restaurants and like, and just like when my mom orders a taco, just being like, how spicy is the sauce? And the waitress being like, I mean, I don't know. It's like spicy. And she's like, I can't eat the spicy sauce. Like, my family's not, they're East Coast people who like are living a mile away from the beach.
But also I think that it is a specific type of suburbia. The show is set in West Covina.
Yeah.
You know, the suburbs of Southern California, many or most of them, are the home of a lot of the kind of ethnic and cultural diversity of Southern California. And
yeah.
So, you know, somebody might think of recent Chinese immigrants living in a Chinatown in a city like San Francisco or New York or Seattle. And here in Southern California, they live in a few towns east of Los Angeles that are as suburban as any other, only all the signs are in Chinese.
Even more so, like, you go to the mall in West Covina, and it's truly mixed. I mean, it's such a melting pot. You know, I think that L.A. city proper is very, like, segregated. A lot of it's been gentrified. But in the suburbs, you get kind of, like, a color blindness that you don't get in the city, but still, like, cultural traditions. I mean, you know, a lot of the great restaurants in West Covina are like Chinese, Korean, Filipino restaurants. But like, I mean, we say it's like people of all cultures going to the same Applebee's. Like, it's this like freshness and this newness where the kind of utopia of it is like everyone gets along and no one really cares like what your background is. Cause like, it's cool. We're all Californians.
But that's not actually that real. I mean, that's sort of what the show is about.
That's like the utopia of it. Obviously, like, it's a lot more nuanced than that. But the idea of portraying the true diversity of a Southern California suburb and also, like, what real Southern California is like as opposed to, like, the Hollywood version or, like, rich people by the beach, that's what we're going for.
I want to play a song from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. This song is called West Covina, and the context is that my guest Rachel Bloom's character has moved from New York to Southern California, ostensibly because she got a great job offer in West Covina. That's not the case. She's telling herself it's because she just needs a fresh start. She's actually in a weird kind of love with an ex-boyfriend from middle school summer camp. And that love is probably a cover-up for deeper emotional issues. The song is a sort of a tribute to the idea of what West Covina might be.
West Covina.
Bunch of cuts.
Tuba anymore.
No, no more band.
Get that best dress.
And also by coincidence, so random, just by chance, would I think it's so remarkable and here right in so rare that this guy Josh just happens to be
I just like listening to that, though. I was like, oh, I love it.
Why do you love it?
I love that song because that's a full, I think it's like a 30-something piece orchestra. And like, I went from doing like music videos on the internet to like getting to write a song for like a multiple piece orchestra. And so I still love the lushness of that. And that type of song, in many ways, that was something that I'd been, that contrast of like glamorous versus reality is kind of the core of the show. And it was something I'd been wanting to do for quite some time. So I still love that song.
Almost every song in the show undercuts the expectations of the genre that it's presented in. You know, they're not, that is on its face ironic, but they're not performed ironically or anything. How do you feel about watching the most unironic musical theater? And I don't mean like high art musical. I'm not talking about Sondheim here. I'm talking about middle brow, unironic, swelling choruses in musical theater.
I have a really mixed relationship with it because on one hand, if you go on my iPhone, there are some very mediocre musicals on there that I will listen to. I mean, I only listened to musicals solely until I was 20 years old. So I'm still catching up to literally every other genre. I feel it's mixed because when I got to school, I went to school to be a musical theater major. And one of the things that I realized was like, oh, so many musicals are bad. Like 70% of musical theater is like not great. And I started writing kind of simultaneously. I got on the sketch comedy group simultaneously with being a freshman musical theater major. And I began to like resent the cheesiness of the writing. But like it still brings like an unironic joy in me. There's this musical called Triumph of Love. Some of it's like great. And other parts are, like, not great, but, like, it, like, elicits an emotion in me that feels akin to a sexual orientation. Like, I can't choose that, like, I love musical theater even when, like, I know the lyrics could be better or even when, like, the emotion for this isn't earned or even when it feels kind of paint by numbers. Like, a big orchestral swell or, like, a bunch of people tap dancing, it makes me smile.
Were you listening to Evita or something when you were going through the emotional torment of adolescence and the rest of us were listening to Nirvana or equivalent?
Yeah, I was listening to Assassins, Sunday in the Park with George, Last 5 Years, Rent. That was a huge one. Rent was a huge one. Thoroughly Modern Millie, there's this song called Forget About the Boy that I would listen to a lot. I mean, I would literally lock myself in a room, listen to show tunes and stare in the mirror and lip sync to them.
Was that because you were doing what your character on the show does, which is to say, so often she is presenting the face of happiness while being deeply and profoundly unhappy?
I mean, it definitely was like an escape. It was a way for me to like explore different roles. I mean, in some ways, my character is, through the musical numbers, trying on different costumes. And I feel like that's, in many ways, what acting is. You're trying on different personas. But absolutely, it was an escape. And for many years, like, I had these kind of different parts of my personality that were, like, either really, really, really happy, like the part that, like, loved musical theater and Disneyland and escapism, and then, like, a really dark side that was, like, sad and anxious and wrote dark poetry and was like really interested in facts about serial killers, and like the two rarely met. And then I discovered Sondheim and Candor and Ebb. So Sondheim Assassins, Sweeney Todd, and then Candor and Ebb Chicago Cabaret. The first time that like, oh, you have this kind of happy sounding music with very dark subject matter.
How did you resolve those two feelings within yourself, or to what extent have you?
Creating. I think creating my own work and doing like a lot of therapy. But I think as I've become more secure in who I am and like proud of like my quirkiness and differences, and I think that as you get older that becomes cooler, and also now it's very cool to like be different and be kind of a nerd, and like it's okay that I admit I'm really into musical theater. I've become okay with it, and I've learned to kind of almost exploit those idiosyncrasies and differences.
I knew people because I went to a theater high school who aspired to a career in musical theater. And like aspiring to a career in entertainment is a fundamentally a road to pain and disappointment because no one actually succeeds at it. And then succeeding at it turns out to really stink for a lot of people. But like but musical theater specifically is such a brutal aspiration because every 18-year-old who wants to be an entertainer wants to do musical theater because it's real fun to do.
Oh, yeah.
I love to be in musical theater. It's the funnest.
Yeah.
But the problem is that, you know, Broadway is like 10 shows at any given time.
Yeah.
Or like 14. I don't know how many are running. But, you know, it's like a total of like 300 jobs and then like six touring companies of whatever at that moment.
It's very competitive. I mean, I can't speak to that because there are also a lot of non-equity touring productions now.
We're not going to get into the math here.
No, no, no. Let's talk about equity contracts.
What I'm trying to get at here, Rachel, is that when you're 18 and you go to theater school, you look around and you realize, oh, not only am I not the most talented person anymore, maybe I'm the 40th percentile most talented person or the 30th percentile most talented person. And then you do the math and you're like, wait a minute, and 90% of these people are going to fail?
Oh, that's exactly what happened to me is I got to school. Well, first of all, I went to school with swollen vocal folds, so my voice was kind of f***ed up. And I actually have bad acid reflux. Like right now, I had a lot to drink last night, so I was in Portland with my husband. And
yeah, we know how it is when you're in Portland with your
husband. You know, in Portland, you get
it. That's Portland, Oregon, folks.
And so I went to school feeling insecure about my voice, and then I ran into all these kids who were like more talented than I was. And I think that comedy was kind of my way of also escaping the expectations I had for myself because I had no preconceived notions about, like, I'm going to be a famous comedian. So I went into it being like, it's okay if I'm, like, not the best at writing sketch comedy. I just want to kind of, like, learn to be good at something that I'm not – don't pressure myself about. And that's how I got good at writing. But it was also a little bit how I escaped the pressure of, like, learning musical theater. And I feel like – it took me years to, like, come to terms with the fact it's okay to try your best and still not be the best. I think I was lazy sometimes so that I could say to myself, oh, I didn't get that part because I was, like, lazy. But, like, I could if I really had wanted to, I could have gotten it. And in some ways, like, I mean, Rebecca's very autobiographical, but I also have, like, a lot of Greg in my personality. And this is a part of me that, like, I feel like I cover, but, like, the slackeriness to kind of mask and protect myself, that was, I think, a lot of what I had in high school and college. And also, like, ADD. And also, like, depressed and not sleeping well. So there were a lot of things.
Let's take a listen to one of the songs that you recorded solo or solo-ish when you were making YouTube videos. It's called The OCD Dance.
Oh, yeah. Okay, now steps. Touch the wall, touch it again, touch it one more time, touch it one more time, touch it again, otherwise bad things will happen. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Woo! Yeah. It's funny. I remember I was on the street in New York. I was filming like this like indie film in New York in 2012. And I remember being on the street calling my producer and co-writer, Jack Dolgen, who now writes on my show, and being like, I have this idea. And I pitched it to him and he went, oh, that's a winner. That's our next video. And then we didn't make it until 2014. But I love that song.
I can see how making things yourself is an escape from the pressure of asking other people for their approval and feeling like you might not do a perfect job.
Oh, yeah. It's completely bypassing it.
I'm not going to tell you whether I relate to that or not. But, yeah, it is a classic way to avoid the part of especially acting where you basically have to ask permission the entire time because somebody has to give you a part.
Oh, my God. Totally. Like, it's complete power. I mean, I see writing – as freedom and power. Like, people say, oh, creating your own work, that's so hard. But, like, I see it as kind of the opposite. Like, oh, my God, I get a say over everything. And the fact that I co-created my show, I'm not afraid of making someone mad at me, like in interviews or like my social media. I'm in charge of my own brand. And so it feels so freeing to be able to do that. Yeah, creating my own work was always my way of convincing myself and like comforting myself and being like, it's okay, you're talented. Because there are a lot of times, I mean, like the first writing staff I was on, I was the youngest, I was the only girl, but more to the point, like, I was the most green, and everyone on the staff was, like, better than I was. They were more experienced, they were more confident. And it was a very competitive room, and I felt really about myself. And that's actually when I wrote some of my best songs, because I wanted to prove to myself, no, you're in this for a reason, you can still write. It's always been my way of sidestepping rejection in some ways.
I want to ask you about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
I refuse to talk about that.
Okay.
I'm here to talk about
your early work.
I'm here to talk about my jeans line.
I'm here to talk about Stephen Sondheim some more.
Yeah.
When you made this show, the premise was your co-creator's idea. Is that true?
Yeah.
What did you think about the premise, which is essentially a woman chases love to the other side of the country and quits her job and dumps everything?
Well, we came up with that after the fact. I mean, we were sitting in a room. Her name is Lynn Brush McKenna, and she's great. She saw my videos, and we're sitting in a room at CBS, and we're talking about, okay, what could be a good musical TV show for us to create together? And I was pitching all these ideas about show business, and she's like, no one cares about show business. And she was like, what about this movie idea I have called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend about, I mean, the highs and lows of obsession. I can't think of anything that lends itself better to musicals. And when we came up with it, it was always from a feminist perspective. It was always a romantic comedy. And as someone who let love throughout my life made me feel powerless, disenfranchised, crazy, obsessed, the opposite of empowered. So I really connected with the premise, and I didn't care, like, if it was PC or not. To me, it felt truthful. I don't care if, like, oh, but that's not, like, a likable character. Like, it's true. And I mean, it's something that very, very intelligent women who are unhappy do. And men and women do it. We let the euphoria and the obsession of love take hold and cover up what's really going on in our lives.
I think the presumption is that if you're going to call your show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, it's going to be one of two things. One is a show where the titular crazy ex-girl, a show from a male perspective where the titular crazy ex-girlfriend is the butt of the joke.
Mm-hmm.
The other is an ironic version of that, which is to say an ex-girlfriend who's not crazy at all.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would expect that it would be a show from the empowered perspective of a woman who is a little bit out of her mind.
Yeah. It's kind of a mix because, like, it's not like she's someone who's, like, it's taken out of context and she's like, oh, no, I didn't mean to stalk you. It's like, no, she's really, like, and to me, she's somewhat of a bubbly anti-hero. I call her, like, a bubbly Walter White. Like, my co-writer says, like, the last kind of bastion of feminism is, like, being able to create female characters who are, like, my character is not, you shouldn't do what she does. I mean, like, I think she does certain admirable things. She's pursuing her happiness, but she's doing it the wrong way for the most part. And the idea of creating this anti-hero that's kind of truthful, was always really cool to me. And I don't view television shows based on, like, whether or not I like the characters. I view them based on, like, if I understand them and I'm excited to see where they go next. And so, yeah, some of the stuff they do is bad, but, like, once you understand their nuances and depth, you're invested in their outcome.
I'll continue my conversation with Rachel Bloom after a break. We'll talk about overcoming social anxiety and allowing yourself the freedom to be happy. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for Bullseye and the following message comes from Independent Lens, an Emmy Award-winning documentary series featuring films from across the country that remind us we're all neighbors. See their unique stories Monday nights at 10, 9 Central on PBS and streaming free on independentlens.org. Presented by ITVS.
At the start of your day, you need to know what's happening in the world, and that's why you turn to Up First, the morning news podcast from NPR, the news you need to take on the day in just 10 minutes. Hear Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Rachel Bloom. She's the creator and star of the TV show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It just wrapped up its third season on the CW. We talked in 2016.
I want to play one more song from the show. So it's a love triangle, this show, in some – I mean, it's a couple different love triangles.
Yeah.
But one of the central ones for the protagonist is that she is in love with this guy, Josh, who's a real sweet, muscle-bound doof. And in kind of classic romantic comedy form, there is another guy who's maybe a little quieter and dorkier – who's friends with him, who's named Greg. And it's subverted at every turn by the fact that Greg himself is dealing with actual issues.
Yeah.
He is not the kind of blank, handsome dork that a romantic comedy would love to present as an alternative.
Yeah.
And this song is a ballad that he sings early on in the first season to her. And it's kind of like a Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire type number. And it's called Settle For Me.
When we're together, I feel so grand. My heart goes tippity tap 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 when I hold your hand. But I know there's another guy you fancy more. So even though I'm not the one you adore, why not settle for me? Darling, just settle for me. I think you'll have to agree. We make quite a pair. I know I'm only second place in this game, but like 2% milk or say 10 beef, I almost taste the same. So won't you settle for me?
He's like a real Broadway star, right?
Oh yeah, he's Hans in the movie Frozen. Too. No, honestly, he's Hans and Frozen.
I feel like, I'm just saying, if I had my own musical comedy show, I think I would surround myself with people who were like Rex Harrisoning, not people with like spectacular, not people from actual Broadway. You know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, our cast is so talented, but it opens up the writing because you can create. I mean, we always wanted to do this, something I've always been interested in. You know, this idea of a romantic song juxtaposed with like what real love is like or what real relationships are like. And the fact that you can do this, the pinnacle of romance, what I see as the pinnacle of romance, this kind of Cole Porter 1930s Fred and Ginger song with someone who has a f-ing amazing romantic voice, but have him sing the worst things about himself was just such a treat to write. I mean, it was so fun knowing that like, oh, this person can really execute that. I mean, if you ask Greg to sing in real life, the character Greg cannot sing. I think, I mean, at some point we have to go to a karaoke bar and just expose that none of these characters can actually sing. Rebecca has a horrible voice, and we heard her sing a little bit in the season finale. Like, she's not a singer. None of these people are singers.
What does the singing mean to you in the show? If it isn't the characters singing, and it's not the kind of unalloyed, brassy, good feelings that often come from a great musical theater number. Why is it that they sing?
It's emotion. It's heart. It's earnest. It's earnest feelings of searching for identity. So even when the song's comedic and they're maybe like they're singing kind of the opposite of the genre, it's still the character earnestly trying to express their emotions. Like Rebecca sings a song feeling kind of naughty, which is kind of a Katy Perry I Kissed a Girl Like song where she sang like really messed up things, but that's an earnest the whole episode, she's been telling herself, oh, no, I just want to be friends with this girl, which is Josh's girlfriend, Valencia. And in this song, for the first time, she's like, no, I want to lock you in a basement and take over your identity. But she's trying to say, no, but it's okay because I have, like, a cute girl crush. And so it's the songs are, like, in some ways pure subtext, but still the characters are trying to view themselves with a societally acceptable lens. Or it's Rebecca viewing the character. I mean, Settle For Me is Greg's voice, but it's Rebecca watching Greg, whereas like a song like What'll It Be in episode 6 is purely Greg and purely how Greg sees himself and wants to see himself. So it's characters being honest, but also like seeing themselves at their in their purest, most ideal forms.
I get the feeling that that conflict was and maybe still is to some extent, but certainly was a great conflict in your life. The idea that maybe at your most successful, you're just tricking people into thinking that you're okay.
Yeah, although, you know, this past year's been insane because I went from having a dead TV show to winning a Golden Globe. And it's been really interesting to, like, be honest with fans and on social media and stuff. And I'll give you, like, one of my favorite examples. The other night, two nights ago, I did a concert at the Bridgetown Comedy Festival in Portland. And I've been working hard on the show. I, like, only rehearsed the day of. I do these hour and a half long sets that are mixes of music and stand-up. And some of the songs are songs from the show, other songs I've been doing for 5 years. And usually I'll rehearse the day before, but I didn't have time, so I rehearsed the day of. And I get on stage, and I'm doing this musical number, I'm a Good Person, from the show. And I go up on the lyrics. There's a key change, and I have no idea what comes next. And I try to fake it, and then I go, stop the music. I'm in front of 500 people, 600 people, and I go, the thing that I fear has happened. I've forgotten the words. And it was, like, really scary. And I mean, it's like the thing that you literally have nightmares about, like not knowing what comes next. And the audience was so supportive and they were like, do it, do it. And I was like, if I forget the words again, will you help me? And enough people knew the words to the songs that the next time I went up on a line, I went up the same part. They helped me through it. And it was just really cool to be transparent about the artistic process. And I'm not afraid anymore if I can just admit to the thing I'm afraid of. And that's why, like, I don't really have secrets as a person. I have boundary issues in that I have none because I take away the fear of the thing by just admitting to the thing and, like, kind of owning it, you know, showing, like, oh, my stomach isn't perfect, or being, like, calling myself the thing and calling it out before someone else can call it out. And in a way, it's, like, it's giving up power, but also it's me taking back my power and being like, no, 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 you can't call me this name because I'm going to say it before you in some ways. But also it's being like, hey, we're all just people trying to get by on this earth and we're all just like trying to stay alive and let's hold hands and sing Kumbaya.
Are you going to be okay when all of this inevitably collapses?
God, I have no idea.
That's
I have no idea. I mean, yeah, man, like, what are we talking about? Are we talking, like, Britney Spears breakdown, or are we talking about just, like, it all fades?
I don't know. You tell me. I mean, it's your life.
You're
the one who's with the constant stream of self-critique deep inside.
Yeah. I don't think I'm garbage. So, like, that's the thing is, like, I have a higher sense of self-worth than, like, I used to. Because I can now fully admit that I'm human. I think, like, writing and creating my own work kind of prevents that, like, full feeling of collapse where it's like, okay, so I'm not getting work. I'll write a play and put it up. Like, there's always that safety of, like, the writing gives me freedom. Or I'll just go insane. Maybe I'll go crazy and it'll be hilarious.
It's fun. It'll be fun either way. How about that?
It'll be a ride.
Either way, it'll be a
hoot. Let's just hope I haven't procreated when I go full craze.
Rachel Bloom, thank you so much for coming on Bullseye. It was really great to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Bloom and I talked in 2016. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend just wrapped up its third season on the CW. You can stream all three seasons right now on Netflix. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are Gloria Calderon-Kellett and Mike Royce. They're the co-creators of One Day at a Time. We talked last year. The show is a reboot of the classic Norman Lear sitcom from 1975. Gloria and Mike collaborated with Lear on the concept of the show, what kind of family to focus on, how to translate jokes and bits that are now more than 30 years old. And the end result is a show that captures Norman Lear's spirit pretty perfectly. It's sincere, but it has a bite, too. It takes an old standby format, multi-camera sitcoms, and turns it into a reflection of our world today, one that is diverse, a little messy, and really funny. The show centers around a three-generation Cuban-American family living in the same home. Penelope, played by Justina Machado, is the main character. She's a mom and a veteran. She works as a nurse and lives with her two kids and her mom, played by the amazing Rita Moreno. In this scene from the show's first season, Penelope's teenage daughter just broke the news to her mom and grandma that she doesn't want to have a quinceañera.
And this one, I don't like her anymore.
I don't care if you like me.
Sounds like you're both on the same page.
Your daughter does not want to have a quinces.
What? Why? We already booked the room, and I found a great band. Okay, it's a DJ. Okay, it's your brother with an iPod and a playlist, but it's a very good playlist.
I researched the history of quinceañeras and found out they're totally misogynistic.
She's been reading again. Why do you let her read?
I know, Mommy. I let her do math, too. I'm a monster.
Gloria, Mike, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Did you just get like a call from Norman Lear saying, hi, this is the most powerful comedy producer in television history?
Kinda. Yes. I was coming out of a spin class. I like to say that because I go twice a year and I kind of want credit for having gone that one time. And my agent said, you know, Norman would like to have lunch with you. And I was like, what? Okay. Like, what are you saying? Okay.
Mike, you didn't know him or...
No. So I went in and he's incredibly disarming and the rest is history.
What about you, Mike? How did you get on board this train?
Oh, I just want to point out I did not get lunch. I'm realizing that as you tell your story. And yeah, they had a meeting with me. I was, you know, nominally available and it was the same kind of thing. Very daunting. We're thinking about doing this reboot and to have anything to do with Norman's shows and somehow, you know, trying to take an existing Norman show and somehow rethink it was like crazy. Once they were talking about, okay, it's really, we just want to do a new show with the same premise, then it became that my brain started percolating a lot. But it was, it's still for a long time, just how that's, you know, people are going to be comparing this. And so it was a great challenge, but it was very, you know, alarming at first.
Did you have memories or feelings about the Norman Lear sitcoms of the era when Norman Lear had was like five of the top 10 shows on television? Or was that just something that had passed from your mind or never entered it?
I'm really young. Mike is an old man. The viewers should just know the truth.
Yeah.
No, I was the original. I'm not that young, sadly. The original came out in 75, which is when I was born. So that all kind of bypassed me. I learned about All in the Family when I was in my 20s and just wanted to find out. So I went to the Paley Center, now the Paley Center, what was the Museum of TV and Radio. And I would spend hours watching a bunch of old shows and kind of teaching myself television. But I feel both like I was robbed that I didn't get to experience it in real time and also a little bit grateful because I think it would have been so much more daunting for me had I known,
yeah,
you know, when I was.
It's such a, you know, I do remember, even though I was young. I mean, I wasn't allowed to watch All in the Family because I was too young. I certainly watched most of the other shows. But then rewatching a little bit as we're preparing for the show, not just All in the Family, I mean, not just One Day at a Time, but All in the Family and the other ones as well. I really was struck by when you're a young kid, you don't pay attention to the emotional parts as much, especially when they're adult issues. And I think that's really where we live, just separately, Gori and I, creatively, on the other shows we've done. That's what we love, funny stuff that then leads to some dramatic stuff. And I was really struck by how much, you know, Norman is, boy, does, you know, those shows wear their heart on their sleeve. And you know, the I can't even get into it. I'm going to cry while I'm, like, describing it. So I'm just going to stare at the wall here and try to get through it. But, you know, there's a scene where I think it's after Gloria has a miscarriage, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, she's in the hospital and Archie is comforting her. And he's there. And, of course, he's just awkward and doesn't know what to say. And I think she says something like, you know, I can't remember. I'm mixing up scenes, but like that was a super emotional scene. And there's a part where she says, "I'm not your little girl anymore," and he says, "You know, don't you ever say that." And it's like this really, I think the term now is kitchen sink drama, but it was really powerful. And you know, those when you're a kid, you're like, "Where's the funny part?"
Well, I mean, I think that you know, the last 25 years of the television sitcom have moved. Have sort of self-consciously moved away from those values, which became in some ways self-parodic in the 80s. I mean, if you think of like what's the yes. top thing you could complain about in 1994, it's a very special episode of something, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That feeling like we have to have feelings in our sitcoms and we're visiting. And, yeah. you know, what's the greatest sitcom of the 90s is Seinfeld, and it's a show that is explicitly
right.
about the opposite of that. That how can we lower the stakes as much as possible and then amplify the stakes on the least important thing ever, right?
And no hugging.
Right, exactly. And I wonder, like, how it's different to write that kind of material, write material that wears its heart on its sleeve, after 20 or 25 years of people running away from that as fast as they can, for the most part.
I mean, it's just what it's a weird thing because this is what we've been writing anyway, so it doesn't feel like we just started writing this. It feels like this is always what we've been writing, and right. as a playwright, this is what I've been writing for the last 10 years too. So it just feels like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I get to do this at work now instead of for free. I'm glad somebody is paying me now to do this stuff and to write in this way because it's what I like, and that's not always what's in vogue. You know, there are definitely shows I worked on where no feelings would have you don't pitch feelings. It's,
right.
it's how many jokes can I think up right now? And that's great too, and that was fun too, but it wasn't. I think it's just we continued to do the thing that we love doing, and thankfully.
No, that's right. It's. I mean, to your point, it's, you know, when the Seinfeld came out, I mean, even Raymond that I worked on at the time was considered against the grain just because every show wanted to be Seinfeld and still continues to want to be Seinfeld for a good reason. It's
yeah,
a fantastic
it's a great show.
But
I'm rewatching it right now, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yes.
No, my son is getting
it's
you
so,
know,
it's God,
amazing.
It's so good.
It's amazing that it has
even
not
the
really,
pilot is really good.
Yeah.
I forgot. It's so good.
It's
anyway.
Funny if you watch the pilot because at the end, if you watch the DVD commentary, at the end as it's fading out, Jerry Seinfeld says, "Well, that was like watching a school play."
Oh.
Like, he's so upset
oh
at the pacing.
Oh, my God. I think
stuff.
It's great. I thought it was so great.
Yeah.
Gloria, when you got this job, you know, when Mike got this job, he can always just cop out and say, "Look, I'm just a hired sitcom hack." You know what I mean? Like,
I've just, done it before.
I'm just there to say, let's close that beat with a laugh or whatever it is that sitcom writers say to each other, right? You are the Cuban-American woman who got the Cuban-American sitcom.
Yeah.
Did that come with, like, a series of responsibilities?
Of
like
wild anxiety? Mm. Yes, it did. Of course. Of course it did. Also, not even just that. I mean, the Latinx community, I know, was also watching and also wanting something. And so I felt a responsibility to them to be specific to my experience so that they would say, yep. Yeah, she got it right. And I feel that resonated with me. And I'm not, you know, that was the response I had been hoping for in the vision board in my mind, was that we would get that type of feedback. So, yeah, this is I was prepared for the hate and have so far it's been pretty
it's the opposite.
Warm.
Come on.
Yeah, it's been a big hug. Yeah, it's been a big hug.
Did you
nice.
Get like story ideas from every Cuban American person on earth? Like, did Jose Canseco send you a note?
Not yet.
That said,
I can't wait for all the Cubans to reach out. She says, terrified.
There's been a lot on, I mean, Twitter and stuff.
Yes, now on Twitter, people are reaching out. But I have just so much. I mean, there's so much from my actual family. So we haven't, you know, talked to me in season 5. but it's unreal. It's unreal.
We'll finish up my conversation with Mike Royce and Gloria Calderon Kellett after a short break. They'll tell me about what it was really like to work with Norman Lear. I mean, the Norman Lear. And no spoilers, but it's just as fun as you'd imagine. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Gloria Calderon Kellett and Mike Royce. Together, they collaborated with Norman Lear to make a reboot of his legendary sitcom, One Day at a Time. The show's second season is up on Netflix now. They talked with me last year.
Gloria, I don't want to put you too deep on the spot, but
go ahead.
What's something that came out of your own family experience that found its way onto
the
show?
Oh, my God. The quinceañeras. I did not have a quinceañera. I was the first cousin in my family not to. That was the story I told Norman in our first meeting, is I feel bad about it now. But at the time, I had been reading about it, and I just thought, what? This is, they'd literally dress you up and be like, all right, she got a period at 12 and now she's a woman and who wants her in the village? Let's dress her up, put some lipstick on this pig and put her out there. Who wants her? I mean, that's, and I was like, what? And now it's obviously not that. But the fact that it had roots in that, I was like, no, I won't do it. I want a car. And look, I also saw my parents are incredible hard workers. I saw how much went into my cousin's beautiful quinceañeras, and they're like a wedding. I mean, people really go into debt to put these things on for their kids. I knew I wanted to go to college, and that was much more important to me. And so I just said, I don't want you to spend the money either. And they were like, okay, and respectful, and I promised them a big Catholic wedding in a church, and I did it! I gave it to them. Get off my back. So that I told Norman that story, and he was like, that's great. And then I told Mike that story, and he was like, that's my daughter.
If my daughter was Cuban, that would exactly be what she did. Yes.
But after that, none of my other cousins had quinceañeras. And I broke this weird tradition, and now I kind of want my daughter, I have an 8-year-old, I kind of want her to have a quinceañera because I think it would be kind of nice. also because she's half, my husband is, you know, Irish, English, Polish. And so I want her to remember her Cuban side. I want that to, you know, I'm now more Cuban than ever, holding up the flags and whatnot, because I don't want my kids to lose any of the cultural specificity.
Was there a part of your professional career, Gloria, where you felt like you had to move away from your Cubanness?
Yes! She says too loud. You know, my very first show, I was on Quintuplets for Fox, Andy Richter. I was on that show as the diversity hire. You get to do that once. Some people, if you're diverse, which I am female, and I check two boxes. Mm-hmm. I am diverse. I am Hispanic and a female. And the moment you get in there, everybody knows you're the diversity spot. And the first thing I felt like I had to do was make them know that, no, I deserve to be here. And I'm going to show you by being exactly like you. And that is, no one told me I had to do that, but I did feel like I'm so different that if I don't assimilate here, I'm going to get eaten up. And that's what I tried to do. And it was really hard. It was hard. It was hard because you want to say, your job as a writer is to bring your experience to the table. And so when you don't have that, you sort of, you do yourself a disservice. But I had nobody to tell me that. I was sitting next to the other, there was one other woman in that room who I love, Jen Fisher. Shout out to Jen Fisher. And we would sit next to each other sometimes. And then I was pulled aside and said, you know, women do that. They sit next to each other. You're doing yourself a disservice. But I mean, a writer did tell me that. And so I stopped sitting next to her and said we would text each other constantly. Things that were happening. But
Andy Richter.
He was lovely. But it was... Yeah, at first you want people to know that you can write these characters as well. I can write Schneider as well as he can write Penelope, you know, and I say that because both of us, I think, can do the other really well. And so I really felt like in order to make a career for myself, and one of the big things as well that happened right after that show for me, sorry to go on a tangent, but is I got offered the George Lopez show. And I thought, as a Latina, I was like, if I take this show right now, my career is my second job, they're going to think I can just write that. And I got How I Met Your Mother at the same time at a much lower position and a lower pay scale. And I felt like I can write How I Met Your Mother way at the time, too. I was, you know, 29. So I was like, I don't know family stuff right now. I don't have kids. I dating stories and, you know, jokes. Let's do that. Sorry. You're getting full uncut Gloria right now. And so I took How I Met Your Mother. And I do feel like by doing those shows and letting people see that I could do the range, because I know a lot of Latino writers that get caught up in the, oh, they're a Latino writer, so they just write Latino jokes and perspective, and that's not true of us. So that's a very long answer. Yes is the answer. Should have just stayed with the yes.
I want to play another clip from One Day at a Time. And my guests are Gloria Calderon-Kellett and Mike Royce, who are the showrunners of the program. So Rita Moreno is on the show. I have no idea she was in her 80s. Mm. Jiminy Christmas, is she?
A babe.
She's a babe, and she's working out there, too.
Yes.
She's not just standing in the corner and making a sly remark. But anyway, her character's name is Lydia. She's the grandmother on the show, and... she just kind of as you would expect, you know, she's a first generation immigrant and does not see the world the same way her daughter and granddaughter do.
Mom, this stuff might not seem like a big deal, but it chips away at you. You gotta call Scott out.
Why would I waste my time? That is right. You will never win men over by confronting them. You flirt with them. You hypnotize them. And then you do whatever the hell you want. And then they will think they are the boss, but really, you are the boss.
Yep.
Yeah.
That is what my mom believes. And my mom still has a very thick accent, and bless her, she was a businesswoman. She worked for many years they both came here when they were 15, both my parents from Cuba. And didn't get to go to college because they had to jump right in the workforce to live, to pay their bills. But my mom graduated from high school, American high school, not knowing the language at 16 because she was just really smart. The education system in Cuba is great. And just did like a trade school, a secretarial program, and then worked her way up, as did my dad. He started as a mechanic in a dealership and worked his way up to management just by sheer work and delight, because they're wonderful, wonderful people. But... you know, my mom really felt like in the business place, she would be running meetings and she'd have that thick accent and would feel like, you have to look great. I go in and I look beautiful and they are better to me. That she believed that. And so the fact that I'm a writer and dress, you know, in jeans and Converse, like, horrifies her. She just doesn't understand how I'm being how I'm taken seriously at all.
Gloria, I want to ask you this. So you are, you know, you have a template in the original One Day at a Time, but... The show's characters are not that close to that. I think they probably are a lot closer to your family and maybe to some extent Mike's family. Mm-hmm. What's it like to cast actors to play the most important people in your lives?
Well, with Rita, it was very easy because Rita and my mother resemble each other. They're both 95 pounds wet and, you know, boob popsicles, but powerhouse. Powerhouse sort of delightful women. I said to Norman in our first meeting when he said, what's your mom like? I said, well, picture Rita Moreno, but with red. And then I pulled out a photo. And I mean, and it's funny that when Rita first wore the wig, I'd keep on being like, oh, my mom. Oh, no, it's Rita. And then one time I was at the monitors and she goes, oh, is Nandi here? Which is her daughter, Fernanda. And she runs over and it's me. And she's like, oh, well, I guess why? Okay. So that was Norman picks up. Norman's Willy Wonka. So you say something and he makes it happen. So it was like, Rita Moreno, let's call her.
Oh, let's get her on the phone.
Sure. And I kind of thought he was joking. And then with Norman, you know, the ambassadors and presidents are calling him all the time. So that was easy. We offered the part to Rita. She was the only one that didn't read. And that was like once we had Rita, it was like, whew, okay. All right, well, we got an EGOT. So what do people want?
Yeah.
Everyone else can just phone it in. And then
the plan had always been to get an EGOT.
Yes.
Like if Rita Moreno had said no, you would have just cast Whoopi Goldberg.
Right, right.
The original plan was all EGOTs, but there are no 12-year-old EGOTs.
Yes, it's true. And then, truthfully, Justina Machado walked in and just blew our minds.
Well, that's what I can say. I mean, so we have Rita Moreno, great, and we're feeling good. And then you realize you write a whole script in the center of the show. I mean, we really, I was having tons of anxiety. We're dead if we can't find the person who is all of these things.
Yes. Who can
funny,
play drama?
Charming,
who can
badass,
be funny?
Emotional. I mean, like so many boxes to check of skill. And then she came in. She was the first person that we saw with Norman. It was a big day. Norman Lear's casting again. It was kind of like a cool. And she comes in and she did the first scene, which was funny. And we laughed our off, and then the second she did a dramatic thing, and but we were crying in the audition.
And chicken skinned. It was ridiculous what this woman came in and did to us in 7 minutes.
Yes. And then she left and Norman goes, oh, that's a good start. No.
That's her. That's her, Norman.
But to be fair, it's like it sounded okay, if that's the first one, how far do we have to go? It must be. But of course it was, all over already.
So I want to play a clip from the show's second episode. This scene is about Penelope, who's Justina Machado's character. And like we said, she is a veteran who left the Army, works now as a nurse in a small doctor's office. And as we listen in, she just got home from work, and she's telling her daughter and her mom about a frustrating meeting she had with a male coworker she calls a bobo. Let's take a listen.
I barely got a word in before el bobo started interrupting me, talking over me. I couldn't even get my point across.
Well, that's just sexist.
No. He's not smacking me on the ass and going, oye, mamita.
Oh, that makes me miss your abuelo.
You want to see real sexism? Be a woman in the Army, okay? You got a 22-year-old white boy from South Carolina marching behind you going, is it hot out here or is it you? Of course it was hot out there. It was a freaking desert. But you want to know how I dealt with that bobo? By being a better soldier than him. And eventually that's how they saw me, not as a woman at all.
Mike Royce, you did a great show called Unlisted that was set in the world of active military personnel who were not in combat and their families and so forth. And I wonder when you were making One Day at a Time, did you decide to bring that context, that military context, into the picture for Justina Machado's character?
Well, it started with Norman. The first day we met with Norman, he's like, we have to do something about the VA. I mean, that's where Norman comes from, more than just, any kind of micromanaging or anything like that. He has an idea of something he wants to tackle. And then how can we do it? How can we work it out? And at first it was going to be the ex-husband is a veteran. But we started talking and thinking, there's no reason not to make our main character also a veteran, because there are so many different nuanced veteran stories across America, especially over the last 15, 20 years with our approach to warfare. There are millions of these people with millions of stories to tell. And
our approach to warfare being frequent?
Yes. And relentless.
Extensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the awareness now of what warfare does to people is obviously a lot greater. And rectifying that has not really been the focus of the government. It probably has been more than it was in the past, but it obviously is a long way to go. So it's a real issue, and it we wanted to make sure it felt organic to this family. So it gave her a real deep biography that we can illustrate, and at the same time, it's not a show about every episode isn't about veterans issues. We can pick our spots and when they're relevant to the family.
Were there things that you had to that you were worried you were going to get wrong? When you were taking on all of these capital I issues, underrepresented groups, so on and so forth?
Well, with my encyclopedic knowledge of Latino culture, I felt we were in good hands.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, yes, yes. The stuff for me that I really wanted to get right is that I'm not gay and Mike's not gay. And so we wanted to, having such a rich relationship with so many gay and lesbian people in my life, I felt a great responsibility to do right by them. And so that's where we are so grateful and lean on the women in our room who did so much to fill in where Mike and I could not on those stories, because we really, to tell a coming out story, to do that in a way that would really reach people and start conversation, that was something we really took seriously and wanted to represent.
For sure. And I mean, the whole, and any issue that we talked about on the show, it really all gets back to specificity. And I think it really gets back to who are you populating your room with? They need to be talented writers, but they should also bring in a lot of different points of view. And that's where diversity, which is for some reason a dirty word now, is super duper important. But the way we felt like, okay, we're in the right direction, is that we're taking people weighed in from their specific points of view, having lived as a Latino, as a woman, for that matter, even as a white guy sometimes.
Yes, yes.
And as a gay person. And so we're taking, you know, these are real people with real experiences. So we try to, you know, keep it there.
Well, Mike, Gloria, thank you so much for taking all this time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to get to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Likewise.
Gloria Calderon-Kellett and Mike Royce from last year. Find One Day at a Time on Netflix now. The second season is even better than the first. Every week on the show, we like to close with a recommendation from me. I'm Jesse. It's The Outshot. There's nothing wrong with a silly movie. Look, I like broadcast news and The Apartment as much as the next guy, maybe even more than the next guy. But sometimes you just want to see something ridiculous. That's where I was at the other day, half a day off. It was a Monday morning. My wife and I bought some popcorn and a Cherry Coke and laughed our rears off at a movie called Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping. Now, I want to be clear. This is not an art film. This film is about 90 minutes of silly nonsense. There is almost no satire in it. Outside of a general theme of friendship conquering all, there's very little feelings. It is basically just a bunch of great, stupid jokes. I guess, theoretically, it's a parody of pop documentaries, and it's possible that I missed a few gags since I haven't actually seen any of those, or at least not any of them since, like, the making of Michael Jackson's Thriller. But mostly, it's just an all-singing, all-dancing string of goofy goofs. Like this, the opening number, which is a bragging song that's called I'm So Humble. I'm a superstar, kick down the door. Got the money in the bills, and I'm also so humble. I'm so humble. I'm so humble. I'm so humble. Bar none, I am the most humblest. Number one at the top of the humblest. My apple crumble is by far the most crumblest. But I act like it tastes bad. That song seriously has a lyric that goes, I'm more humble than Dikembe Mutombo after a stumble left him covered in a big pot of gumbo. How could you hate that? The film's by The Lonely Island. It's basically a group project by the three of them. If you only know one of their names, it's probably Andy Samberg. He brought the trio to SNL. The three members of the group have stuck together for quite a long time now, but only Samberg's a star. Actually, the film's structure follows their trajectory. Samberg, Yorma Taccone, and Akiva Schaffer play the three members of a boy band who are torn apart by Samberg's career success. Then, of course, by the end, reunited. In all their work, they've shown an affection for the culture of pop music, and maybe more importantly, an affection for each other. They've got enough smarts and sincerity to pull off white guy joke rapping, which is no small feat. And they have enough sweetness to pull off the disastrous joke single from the movie, Finest Girl, parentheses,
Bin Laden song.
Was a freaky kind of girl, kept up on current events from all around the world. More specifically, one event. The time Osama bin Laden got shot in the head. She said, do me like that, but I couldn't track the metaphor. That said, I can see you horny like a stegosaur. That said again, your request is so irregular. She put on a beard, I started looking at the exit door. Then a turban, then a tunic. She said, invade my cave with your special unit. I said he wasn't in a cave, but there was no stopping. She demanded.
Of course, a movie that is this goofy can sort of die on the vine. It basically has to be packed with good jokes. And Popstar is. Even the celebrity cameos. They appear as talking heads. Nobody hams it up. Not even Mariah Carey. At one point, the RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan goes, the higher you get, the harder you fall. Ask any coconut. Which is perfect. I mean, ask a coconut. That would be good. Ask any coconut? That, my friends, is craft. Oh, and also there's a part where the singer Seal gets attacked by wolves.
Seal! Seal, come on, hurry! Are you okay?
I'm fine for a second.
Seal! Oh,
Seal!
Oh! Oh my God, you got him, dude!
Don't worry, I've been in this situation before. I think I got these scars.
From wolves?
Now let's get out of here.
Seriously, if you're not on board this movie, by the time Seal gets attacked by wolves, I don't know, maybe it's not for you, and that's cool. But for me, playing hooky with a big bag of popcorn, Popstar is a home run. That's my out shot. That's all for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where lately the tow trucks have been out in force. Please do not park your car on Wilshire Boulevard after 4 p.m. They are towing. Show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He had help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellows at MaximumFun.org are Jesus Ambrosio and Shayna Deloria. Our senior producer at MaxFun is Laura Swisher. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our theme was recorded by the Go Team and provided to us by Memphis Industries. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, all of them are free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And while you're at it, you can check out the Bullseye page on Facebook. This week, an interview between the late TV legend Huell Howser and the similarly legendary rock band The Clash. You can also follow Bullseye on Twitter. We are at Bullseye. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.